So we've been saying that this is the last, unless Carolyn gets carried away, this is the last installment of talking about peace and peacemaking. We're talking that Carolyn and I would do this last one together. And so we were talking this morning a little bit about what we would do this evening. And Carolyn started telling me a portion of her story that I hadn't heard in any detail before, in the context of this subject. And as I was listening to her tell the story, I just thought, I was struck by the honest telling of it, which I always appreciate. I was struck by the unique character of the story. I was also struck by how much it sounds like the stories in its general shape of many, many people that I know. And I think Carolyn's story, I think does a wonderful job of framing the dilemma that lots of us have experienced when it comes to the shape of our faith as we've been given it, no longer being adequate for the challenges that are coming through it. And so I thought, when we were thinking about how we would do this tonight, I couldn't think of a better way to engage with the topic than to invite Carolyn to retell some of what she told me. And so I think that's going to be how we'll start, right? Okay.
Sure.
Let's go with the time.
So this wasn't the original plan, and that's why you might find that it could have made sense better at the beginning of the series than at the end, but I don't think that's really a big deal. Tim was asking me questions about where we were going to go tonight, and like he said, I was telling him the reason why I wanted to do this series at all to begin with. That's why maybe it would have made sense at the beginning. But anyway, he thought that that was helpful to the whole series for me to share that here. So I'm going to do that. I would say like 4 or 5 years ago, if I can really put a time point on it, I'm not really sure. But 4 or 5 years ago, I think is when I started struggling the most with becoming disillusioned with the framework in which I understood Christianity. It started for me to feel like it was kind of this small suffocating box that people were saying everything has to fit in here, but so many things weren't fitting into the box. And I was realizing that a lot of the people throughout the world wouldn't be able to fit into this box either, even if they wanted to. And that was a really important point for me as well. Even if they wanted to, even if they tried, they were never going to fit in a small little box in the way that I understood Christianity. And me and Tim actually talked about an example of that, like things like if you have to, you know, read your Bible every day to be a good Christian, then like what about the blind? What about the illiterate? What about people that don't speak a language the Bible's written in? What about people that, you know, like just, you can go on and on. That's just one very small example, but I was like, this framework obviously wasn't working for me, let alone everyone in the world. And so I was having a lot of trouble with that. And I was having a lot of trouble with the fact that, to me, the way I understood Christianity, it seemed like the focus was on things that were becoming more and more, in my mind, meaningless. And there was a lack of focus on the things that I thought were crucial. Again, that was my perspective and understanding of Christianity as it had been taught to me, and my opinion of what was meaningful and meaningless in the world. So obviously that's all subjective. But that's what I was struggling with. And I started wanting to like just throw out large chunks of Christianity, like, okay, well, obviously, you know, just to go back to the Bible example, obviously reading your Bible every day can't be what makes you a good Christian, you know, so throw that out. And maybe, you know, and you go on and on and on, you're like throwing out chunks that you're like, this doesn't really fit in my reality. But I kept kind of running into a wall with that, where I felt like the world of Christianity was screaming at me that you're not allowed to throw anything out, and if you throw anything out, then you're kicked out of the group. That's simplistic, and obviously that's not directly what I was being told, but that's what I heard through speakers I listened to, through churches I went to. It felt like if you try to say any of this isn't, you know, 100% truth, exactly how we want you to swallow it, then you're out of the group. That's what it felt like to me, and it felt like if I voice that I'm rejecting this piece or this piece, then people are going to say things like, oh, you know, you're struggling in your faith, you're losing touch with God, all these kinds of things that I was scared, I didn't want people to say about me or think about me. So you can see how, like, it was quite a dilemma. And it was definitely an all or nothing paradigm that I was struggling with. Like, if you don't take all of this, then you're not allowed to have any of it. And as you can imagine, there were some vital pieces of Christianity that I didn't want to throw out. And in fact, I was willing to pretend that I would take all of it continually so that I didn't lose the pieces that were vital to my existence. If that makes any sense. So that put me in a very awkward position where it felt a little bit like faking it and a little bit like not at the same time and all that kind of thing. So I was explaining this to Tim, and I was explaining how at this time I was wondering whether this was an ending for me with my relationship with Christianity, as you start to wonder, like, more and more pieces started to not fit, and it was more and more difficult for me to feel like I was faking having these pieces and in order to keep these pieces. I know that's starting to get out of control with lack of clarity, but anyway, I'm sure that you all can fill in what those pieces could be or what they might look like. I'm sure many of you have struggled with the same kind of thing. And so I was wondering if it was an ending. It felt like an ending, and it felt like I was starting to mourn, having to let go of the whole picture, and that was really hard for me. It's been about 5 years that there wasn't any revelation point, but over the last 5 years, I think I've started to transition into viewing this as a beginning instead of an ending. And I would still say on a bad day, I view it as an ending. And on a good day, I'm hopeful about a beginning. But you can imagine that goes back and forth. But I'm trying to envision it as a new beginning instead of an ending. And I found that the discussion on preemptive peacemaking, and specifically some of Brian McLaren's ideas about from New Kind of Christianity, as well as the podcast I talked about originally, Preemptive Peacemaking, provided some really good insight that encouraged this idea of it being a new beginning and traveling in a new direction towards a new perspective. So that's why I wanted to go through. That's a really big intro to why I wanted to go into the topic that we have for the last three times I spoke. And I found something when I was thinking about how I was feeling and how I could describe how I was feeling over the last 4 years. And I found a poem that I wrote 4 years ago. And it was funny because I kind of like hadn't remembered what was in the poem. And when I read it, I was like, wow, that's a really good explanation of exactly how I've been feeling. So I thought that I would share that with you today because it might actually be more clear than what I just said up until this point. Maybe not. So, anyway, either way, I'm going to share it. I did not start this. Was I supposed to start this?
Oh, it's going.
Oh, okay. Take that out, what I just did there. No. Okay. So this was in 2008. I've been thinking about the joust between the vision of wisdom and the blindness of faith. I've been thinking about why a pursuit of knowledge, wisdom, seems like a pursuit of God, a pursuit that only leads to a greater feeling of Him and a lesser feeling of us, a pursuit that leads to a greater feeling of distance between Him and us. Does it work? Does wisdom bring us closer to God, or only make us more able to see the distance more clearly? Why is it that the more I learn, the more I learn of how much more there is to learn and how little I already know? Why is it that the more I learn, the less satisfied I become with what I thought I already knew? I've been thinking. Perhaps our thinking is too narrow. See, we see the world and its concepts, however abstract they may seem to us, inside the box of what we've experienced already. Perhaps that's why John couldn't describe apocalypse, Jesus couldn't describe the kingdom, and Solomon couldn't describe wisdom. Couldn't? Well, they couldn't in a way that we'd clearly understand. All they could use were comparisons. So, in our shallow perspective, built on comparisons, we envision a pathway towards God. A journey towards a closer relationship with Him. It's that pathway, that journey, that I get caught up on. My perspective of comparisons tells me that a forward motion gets me closer to my destination. The shortest distance between any two points is a straight line. Therefore, I desire that my pathway toward God would be linear. Or at least I expect it to be so. And when it's not, I've failed. Or at the very least, faltered. I'm dejected and all is vanity. Neck broken, eyes blank, disabled and stationary. Or am I? Is failing to move forward in our comparison perspective of a forward motion, a linear pathway, pathway between two destinations, the beginning and God, placing me at a standstill? I've been thinking. Perhaps my problem is at the root of the paradigm, usually is. What if there aren't two dots, yours and God's? What if there are actually more, many more? What if our lives are more like a puzzle of connected dots? We're building a picture that we can't see, but it is there. We think we're moving forward and backward, side to side, but we're only connecting dots. Dots that need to be connected to add clarity to the picture. And yet, just like those damn connect the dots, more connected dots does not always equal more clarity. The challenging ones, the ones that are not so clearly an elephant, they can throw you. Just when you think you know what it is, three more dots assures you you were wrong all along. Am I near the beginning or the end? Is there an end? Perhaps every completed picture is really just the beginning of a new picture. Starting a new picture requires a step away from clarity towards uncertainty, and disillusionment follows. Exhausting, exasperating. Like Solomon, we may find that our wisdom will do us little good, and discernment may not ease a single apprehension, but at its best, it could bring the world inexplicable breaths of life. When I gave my heart to know wisdom and to seek the task which has been done on earth, even though one should never sleep day or night, and I saw every work of God, I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. And though the wise man should say, I know, he cannot discover. That's what I've been thinking.
So when Carol and I were talking about this, she mentioned the poem to me, and we discussed its place in this conversation, and she asked if I wanted to see it in advance of this evening. And I said I didn't wish to. I wanted to have my own experience with it in this context and respond out of that. I realized with something like what you did, Carolyn, there's a different piece that'll lodge for each one of us in our imagination. Maybe partly because I'm a visual creative, the piece that lodged in my mind this evening was the connect the dots, and the part that all of a sudden makes us wonder if it isn't an elephant. And when I think about that experience, when I think about what a lot of us have encountered in Christendom, in particular around questions of conflict and peace, and the process of peacemaking, or bringing to be a peaceable kingdom. I think there's a really telling illustration of the broad problem that a lot of us have experienced, and that I think is part of what your story comes out of. And one way to articulate that problem is, oh man, this gets into all sorts of things we don't have time for, but we'll come to everywhere in other conversations. One way to articulate the problem is to understand that most of us have either come into Christendom or been trained in Christendom sort of under the ideas of the zenith of modernity. And that set of ideas, broadly speaking, about Christianity has been in the Western Church, and maybe more particularly in the Western Evangelical Church, very prescriptive. These dots in this order, and you have to only use these dots in this order, will make only this. And in many ways, I think if I took your connect the dots illustration and moved from a few dots making a clearly prescribed or understood object to many dots, I would say there's another aspect to it, and this is where it gets a little weird. We have to really shift our thinking. Not only are there a lot of dots, but they're moving. They're not static. And this is one of the profound shifts in our age about how we know things, including how we know things about God and how we make sense of what we know about God in the world in which we live, a world in which things are constantly moving and shifting and changing. Very, very dynamic time in our cultural history. When it comes to peacemaking, there's a unique intersection here, and it depends how you think about the history of humanity. I'm going to choose to think about it as very, very long chronologically for the moment. If we understand the unfolding reality of human civilization to be millions of years long, statistically, the period that we've been tracking things like peacemaking and conflict resolution and all of that is incredibly brief, less than 1% of the history of humanity, chronologically. And it's very intriguing that it's in that relatively short percentage of human history that violent conflict has completely shifted its statistics in terms of frequency. That as far as we can discern, once we shifted from being hunter-gatherers and nomads to being rooted in agriculture and on a piece of land, conflict skyrocketed. How come? One way to understand it, sort of a sociological, anthropological way to understand that, is because when we stopped moving around, we shifted from an expanding universe to a fixed universe. We shifted from a world in which there was always more possibilities as long as we cooperated and sought them together. There was always enough game, enough food, but we might have to help one another find it. We needed one another. But when we shifted to, this is my piece of land, that is your piece of land, and if I get more land, that means you get less land. So not an expanding pie, but a fixed pie, vision of the world in which we live, all of a sudden, violent conflict just went through the roof. Now here's what I find most intriguing about the trajectory of this, and which will lead us to the peacemaking conversation. We live these days in a universe, well, let's not make it too big, and a culture, certainly, in which we're shifting back. Because increasingly, the thing that we are after, that we value, is not land. It's not a thing with a fixed boundary. It's knowledge. And knowledge is an expanding pie, not a fixed pie. How much knowledge is there to go around? Well, and if you're going to keep seeking it or not, doesn't it? Are we going to run out of knowledge? If I have more knowledge, does that mean you have less knowledge? No. In fact, when I share my knowledge with another person, what happens to it? It multiplies. And so we're moving, as a culture, from there's only so much to go around, a culture of fixed resource and essentially a mindset of scarcity that says, get what you can, because if you don't get it, somebody else is going to get it, and it'll be gone, to a culture in which the possibilities are once again expanding outwards. In a fixed resource universe, when it comes to peacemaking or conflict, maybe to start with a negative thing, the environment in which you work is one of win-lose, right? Because there's only so much to go around. Which means if you get what you want, it's not the same thing as I want. You won and I lost. You got more, I got less. And that's how we frame conflict resolution in that kind of worldview. But in an expanding resource worldview, an expanding pie world, that's no longer the case. And so for the first time in the near history of humanity, we are moving into a culture where we need to shift the way that we think about conflict and peacemaking from either I win or you win to what would happen if we actually started to look for the third player in this, there's a third way or a third perspective or a third side. Conflict resolution models use different kinds of language about that. But this idea, not just of win-win, but of gain-gain, but only if we stop thinking win-lose. Win-lose is prescriptive, limited thinking. And it's very, very hard to actually imagine what it would take to be Christians that bring a peaceable kingdom into the world, unless you think about an expanding world. If you think about a limited world, then either you're a Christian or you're not a Christian, and if you're not, and I can make you one, then I win, and if I can't, then you make me what you are, and you win, and I lose, and it's that same mindset, right? So part of what Carolyn did for us, and what you're going to recap, is sort of broken narratives around conflict. So listen to the recap of the narrative, broken narratives around conflict resolution, with that kind of that idea of what sort of thinking is going on behind these narratives, kind of running in the background, and just see what happens to the way you imagine the narratives. If you think about yourself in them, how would I behave under this story, under this storyline?
Yeah, these narratives come from a time where the world is deeply entrenched in conflict, and they linger regardless of conflict or peace times, and what they all have in common is the us and them thinking. This is a recap. We talked about these stories, but just to remind you, the domination story is us over them thinking. The revolution story is us against them. The purification story is us getting rid of them. Victimization story is us in spite of them. The isolation story is us away from them. And the accumulation story is us competing with them. If you want to be reminded in more detail of what those can look like, you can look to the podcast and some of the other peacemaking series talks. But basically the point is, the overarching theme is us and them thinking, seeing other groups as other. So that's the overarching theme of all those narratives, and they tend to all lead to conflict.
So what happens if we bring the story that we think of in Christendom, the story that we call the gospel, which just is good news, what happens if we bring that story into this conversation?
Well, these narratives, as I've mentioned before, all come from Brian McLaren's podcast, Preemptive Peacemaking. And tragically, I found that the podcast cut off right before he got to the gospel story, so I don't know what he said. But I did read A New Kind of Christianity, where he goes into detail on his perspective on the gospel, so I still use that to enlighten this perspective. But I came up with a number of questions from reading his book about a possible gospel story and how that can differ from us and them thinking. What makes that different? The first of those is, what if Jesus didn't come to start a new religion? What if he didn't come to start a new religion that was meant for one group that would continue this us and them paradigm? What if instead he came to announce a new way of thinking, a new way of life, a new way of peace that was good news to all people of every religion? That was the first question I thought of directly from Brian McLaren's book, New Kind of Christian. Also, what if the gospel was good news for everyone, not just for Christians, but for all nations? It could be good news that doesn't form a new group in which to consider everyone else other, but instead reconciles people to one another. What if the gospel isn't simply a prescriptive set of rules in order to leave earth, avoid hell, and get to heaven, but instead about God's will being done on earth as it is in heaven for all people of every religion now, today? In his book, New Kind of Christian, Brian McLaren summarizes the good news of the gospel of Jesus in this way: the kingdom is at hand. It's a quick summary, but it's here now. That's the point. So what does that mean for us, and how would that understanding shift our paradigm of the gospel if we believe that to be true? So we wanted at this point to open up to some comments from you guys, if you want to add them to the conversation, which I would think would be fantastic. Maybe I should pass this around this time.
I'd be curious personally to hear what people's thoughts are about the implications of some of those ideas.
Maybe we should pass the piece again. outside. I'm supposed to sit down. That's a great comment.
What do you guys think of the idea that Jesus didn't come to start a new religion? Because mostly if you ask somebody on the street who Jesus was, a good percentage of your answers are going to be the founder of Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I would, in my thoughts, would differentiate those ideas, starting a new religion versus like the kingdom is now. I think of it as, I look at like how Paul talks about where we're going to go with this Christian thing right at the beginning. And he talks a lot about the differences between the Jews and the Gentiles. And he doesn't seem very concerned about whether they stick with their traditions of one culture or another. You know, I don't care if you're circumcised or you're not. I don't care if you, you know, practice as a Jew or you're a Gentile. It doesn't matter, you know. And the verse you brought up actually last Monday was the only thing that matters is faith expressed through love, which is Galatians 5:6. And so I think this idea that has been forming over time slowly, and so maybe it's like almost a seepage, is that part of following Jesus is taking on the cultural aspects of westernized Christian culture and saying that that's part of the imperative of following Jesus. So to be a Christian, you know, you do Christmas like this and you do prayer like this, and here's the way you pray to Jesus to become a Christian. Here's the way you do these things. And I'm sure there's tons of examples I'm not thinking of. And so this idea that Jesus wasn't necessarily saying that there needed to be a new group formed that practiced in this certain way, but throughout the world, all nations could have the good news of Jesus and could encounter a new way of life within their different cultures and nations. I think that would be how I would see the difference. I don't know if you have something to add to that.
Well, what happens if we imagine that what Jesus did was act out something that was true, is true, and always will be true? It didn't become true when he acted it up. He gave us an embodied example of rather unique if we affirm the idea that Jesus was fully God and fully human, to be sure, but still an enactment of something that pre-existed Christ and that continues in Christ's embodied absence. Jesus doesn't have to be here for this to be true about God. It was true before Jesus showed up, and it was true after Jesus left. It is the nature and character of God.
Another freeing thought that just came to me is, you know, Jesus a number of times talks about how, you know, whatever you do for the least of these, you do for me. And the reason I find that that's a freeing thought, because there's the implications there are widespread that Jesus doesn't even require, you know, credit to be given to him, thought to be given to him. It's just like following in his footsteps, doing good, pursuing truth. Like this is all, without even recognizing it, can be connected to him. And so that in itself seems like a different story than we hear in many of the world's religions, where you have to do things such a way and you have to be thinking this exact thing and following these patterns or these rules. And so I think that, to me, that kind of expression opens up and broadens my idea of following Jesus and what that could look like, with possibly not even ever have heard his name in your life.
So what you're talking about then seems to be some kind of core or foundation that is then repackaged or sort of can fill a different, I mean, like water fills a different cup, it takes a different shape. There's this core thing that can take on different shapes and different cultures and different in different family styles and different nations and different periods of history. And so then I would say Tim's word Christendom has done it well and poorly throughout history. Right? So you take a guy like Ignatius, who goes or Franciscan, St. Francis of Assisi, who goes and does this really beautiful thing, gives away all he has, and all his parents have, and their chagrin. And then we do this thing afterwards where we create a new movement after him. And we create a new religion around what he's done.
Yeah, we codify his story.
Yeah.
You
make an index of it and say, you have to do this, 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 and this, and then you can become a Franciscan or an Ignatian or a...
It's interesting, Brian McLaren actually brings up specifically, in his book, he talks about a number of verses that Christians will often use that really do seem to suggest that Jesus was thinking in a kind of us, them, in-group, out-group framework, and he discusses how they could be seen in a different light, touching on possibilities. And one of the things he brings up is where Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the light, and no one gets the Father except through me. And one of the things he talks about is there's a perspective there that Jesus is narrowing the path, right? I'm the only way. If you go a different way, you're not in the group. You're not going to make it into heaven. This is how it's working. You know, these are the rules. And instead, he wonders if we could look at it from the opposite side. And instead of saying, so this is the only way, him saying that all truth, all good, all life is embodied in him. So if you're headed towards good and truth, then you're headed towards Jesus. So it's actually a broadening instead of a narrowing of the scope. He was trying to express to his disciples who he is, not the only way to get to heaven, right? He was talking at this time about how he was going to heaven and they couldn't currently follow, but he's explaining to them how to continue to be followers of him on earth, disciples of him, to go out to all nations, because that's what he discusses at this point, how they can continue to be part of the kingdom here and now on earth. So I think that was an interesting, like, that with everything that we've learned, and when I'm talking about how a framework I was taught and how I became disillusioned with my framework of Christianity that I began with, it makes me wonder if you just even rethink some of those things that you've been taught, this means this, and you take a moment to wonder, what are all the possibilities and the meanings of this phrase, what that could open up to in your life and in your understanding of the gospel and Christ and his calling on us today here as a part of the kingdom.
Jason, I think your idea of there being a core is an excellent and I find a really helpful one. The way the story shape seems to me, the core keeps being someone over and over again for me. And every time I try to turn the core into a code or a set of propositions, I get myself into hot water. If only because I realize that there isn't a code that can contain the core. That in its essence, whatever is at the heart of this is both knowable and mysterious, because what's at the heart of this is God, God's self. And as a Christian, my best available path into getting a better grip on what that might imply, what that might mean, is to walk in the way of Jesus. But that's a little bit like confusing the handle with the jug. And I think the way of Jesus is actually meant to carry me to God, not to turn me into a combatant on behalf of a new religion, which is a very different matter. And if I understand the primary reason for Jesus coming and showing me the way, as Jesus himself articulated it, which is to point me toward God, because Jesus was always deflecting people who were like, oh, you're the guy. Well, I'm actually here to point you to something. It was sort of a very rough paraphrase of Jesus' life and times. But that's kind of how it kept coming up, right? Nope, not me, the Father. Bigger, think beyond. Look through. Look at what I'm trying to gesture toward. Go there. And if we start thinking like that, and we start thinking about the thing that's being gestured toward and that we're being drawn toward as the mystery of God and the engagement with God and God's engagement with us, then if the character and nature of God is to draw us and to do that creatively, then all of a sudden the possibilities for how that could happen get way, way bigger than the prescribed shape of a particular religion at a particular time. One of the lovely things that opens out of that set of ideas is that this whole story that we have in our sacred text, this whole biblical story, is full of ways to God that we no longer practice culturally. But they don't cease to have merit. They don't cease to be ways to God. The fact that I'm not going to go home tonight and check my calendar, my lunar calendar, and wonder if tonight's the night to kill the calf, you know, and make a blood sacrifice, because if I don't, God's pissed and he's coming for me. The fact that I don't worship that way, but people did, and God met them in that, doesn't invalidate that. Right? Otherwise, I got this whole chunk of the story, among other things, that I have to just sort of go, well, I guess that's outmoded and has nothing to say, and out it goes. But instead of that, I don't know how many of you were here for Lego Monday, but instead of that, I've kind of got this core essence that I keep coming back to and going, in this cultural framework, what does the assembly of this core quest look like? What's actually going to open into leading me deeper into the heart of God? And what is going to close the loop? What is going to bring the heart of God deeper into my life and into the life of the kingdom? Which Jesus was constantly saying, look around you, you're in it, about. So somehow we've drifted a long ways from there, I think, into this idea that what Jesus is here for is to help us stay out of the bad kingdom and get into the good kingdom. And by the way, they're both outside of time somehow, so don't worry too much about now. Just make sure you've got that bit squared away and then carry on. And when you stop breathing, you know, if you got it right, you'll be in the right bin. Which just leads to a completely different way of thinking about what it means to preemptively make peace in the world. Just completely different.
Well, and it takes away from the necessity to seek peace in the world, which a lot of these other narratives do as well. Like we talked about us away from them. This is the isolation story. So if us as Christians are like, this is just an example, this is not a statement I'm making at all. If us as Christians believed like, oh, any adherents of Islam are bad and they're going to hell and, you know, I don't want anything to do with that, but we're just going to hide over here in North America where there's less of those people. It's that idea.
It might not be true this week, but it was last week.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's this idea of us away from them, then we're okay, you know, as long as we're good and Christian, doing the right thing over here. This is one of the narratives that takes away from the idea of peacemaking throughout the world and the gospel being good news for all nations. So I think that's just one good example of how a different paradigm might take away from the spreading of peace and good news for all people of all religions.
So Carolyn, if you brought us back to the them and us statements,
yeah,
and you gave us a framework in that sort of same language, because this language is what we have to work with here. I mean, God knows we crash into the limitations of it constantly, but it's our currency. It's what we've got to work with. And we're working with ideas and belief and all of that. So if you were going to take that language framework and you were going to say, what if we tried to imagine the gospel articulated this way?
Right.
How would you say that?
Well, so, like we talked about it, all these narratives that we've gone through are us and them, as separate, distinct, right? So us over them, us against them, us getting rid of them, us in spite of them, on and on. The question was, what happens then if we shift our paradigm to thinking something like, we are them? It's the one paradigm, if you say, we are them, it actually says there is no distinction between us and them. It goes from other to one another. So instead of wondering, for example, how they could think like that, talk like that, act like that, be like that, it might mean believing something like that could have been me. What if I had experienced that? What if I had thought like that? What if I had been taught that? That could have been me. Instead of believing I could never do that, it's the idea that all humankind is capable of every kind of evil and every kind of good, and perhaps the right circumstances could have ended you up square where you see the other currently. I've always asked myself, that was always a big thing that I worried about to do with Christianity. I'm like, well, if Christianity is the way and it's the only answer, if I was born in Afghanistan, would I be going to hell because I'd never heard this way? You know, like, so that's such a worry. It's the idea that, like, because I was always thinking that way. Like, what if I was like this? What if I was born here? If you want to even go more localized, often you find in Winnipeg that there's an issue between European settlers and who would not consider themselves European settlers anymore, but Aboriginal people here in Winnipeg, and they might be like, oh, how could these people be acting this way, and how could they think like that, and how could they do this, and how come they can't get over this? And instead of thinking, that could have been me, what would it be like if I had that experience? Would I have reacted the same way? So it's a we are them type of thinking, and they are us. How would we view other religions and the adherents of those religions if we viewed Jesus as a gift to the world instead of to one group or one religion? What if we could celebrate the good and lament the bad in every religion, Christianity included? And what if the kingdom of heaven that Jesus spoke about actually transcended as well as included all religions at the same time? That's an interesting thought. And if we all thought like that, another question is, where would the line be between good and evil that humankind seems to be so comfortable with drawing? Could you even draw such a line? And if not, what effect would it have on conflict if you can't draw a line between good and evil? And what if there was a way to be a committed follower of Christ that doesn't require us to demean and discredit all other religions and their adherents? What would that mean for peace?